Welcome back to Makerspace, a podcast run by Christian Education National. I'm Sam, and this week I speak to Dan Anderson, Director and CEO of the Lachlan Macquarie Institute. LMI trains men and women for wise leadership in politics and culture through internship programs and conferences. So Dan is very well connected to a wide variety of thinkers and decision makers, and it was the perfect opportunity for me to ask some spicy questions around some topics that can often be fairly polarizing. In this conversation, we talk about the temptations and risks with political engagement in Australia. We touch on his PhD that explored forgiveness and delve into some conversation around what responsible engagement with Indigenous communities might look like. I sent him a list of questions beforehand and then proceeded to go wildly off script. So he did well, and I think you'll find it helpful too. So here we go. Dan Anderson, it is great to be able to chat to you this afternoon.
Likewise, Sam. Thank you so much for having me.
No worries. Now, you're the director or CEO of LMI. I don't know if you're able to give a little bit of background about what LMI is and what you guys are up to in Canberra.
Yeah, no, the Lachlan Macquarie Institute, LMI, has been running for about 12 years. We're based just outside of Canberra. And we were originally started up as an internship program within the Australian Christian Lobby, but then spun off as a separate organisation a while ago. Our mission really is to raise up wise leaders for politics and culture. We have a vision to do that, to raise people who are biblically faithful, culturally intelligent, and positively engaged for the common good. So, effectively what we're trying to do is think through how do Christians engage in public life, particularly in cultural leadership? How do they do that in a way that has integrity and authenticity as Christians, but also has a good understanding of what the culture is, where it's going, and can be effective in doing that? That's kind of bundled up in our definition of wisdom. And we run two fellowship programs every year. So our core thing that we do is we run a three-month residential program here in Canberra, which involves a placement into Parliament, as well as us flying in lecturers and teachers from all around the country from different universities and theological colleges, which train people in some biblical theological foundations, some cultural and political history, a bunch of practical skills, so media training, negotiation, how to write. We do a lot of debating, the kinds of stuff that you're going to need to be on the front foot in public life. We package all of that up, as I said, in about a three and a half month program, including an internship placement into Parliament. And then, as I said, we've run that twice a year for about 12 years now. So about a bit over 200 people have been through our program.
Great. I remember you saying at some point that a certain policy was being reviewed through Parliament, and something like at every stage within or with every party, there was someone, an LMI grad, who had basically been involved in that somehow. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I'm really proud of that. It sometimes makes us sound a little bit like some sort of shadowy organization. It's I have to be very clear that it's not, LMI is not a lobbying organization. We don't tell people how to vote or the positions they should take on issues. We train people how to think and how to think out of their Christian faith. But yeah, you're alluding to something that I was really chuffed by a while back, where there was a significant policy going through, a bill going through Parliament, and there were a chance for public submissions. And so people were coming in and bringing perspectives to bear from lots of different backgrounds, think tanks and lobby groups. And I think there was a particular day on which the submissions were being taken in the Senate, and every group that was putting in a submission had an LMI person who was either leading the organisation or working as a researcher. So we provide really well-trained, thoughtful staff across both sides of politics, across a whole bunch of different organisations.
Right. And for you, how important is the residential aspect of that? Because you don't sort of run like a university, obviously. You've got everyone living on site and doing life together and everything that comes with that. What is important about that, do you think, to you guys?
Yeah, that's something that I think is really significant at LMI. And it was a decision that was taken by the organisation before I joined it, but I'm a huge fan of it. Another way to think about LMI is as a kind of experiment or innovation in how we do higher education. And I've spent most of my adult life in and around universities and university ministry. And I think it's observable over the last couple of decades that our universities are in a bad place. They're in a bad place financially at the moment, but they're also not doing some of their classic missions of actually forming people in terms of character as well as knowledge. And we need different kinds of institutions, I think, to make that up. And I think as Christians, we're really being forced to confront that reality. One of the temptations in the face of that is to move everything online. And universities are doing that. Lots of Christian teaching institutions are doing that as well. But there's something about the way that God made us as embodied creatures that really suffers when we get placed into online environments. And particularly if you want to train people in character, spending time with each other, working alongside each other, doing the washing up together, sharing a room, these are the kinds of places where I think God brings to the surface the rough edges and corners that he wants to sand back and actually helps us to grow. And so I'm a huge fan of that. It's one of those sort of bold decisions. I think it's easier to see a business case and a market if you go online. But the actual mission that we want to achieve, I think, is best served by being in person together. Yeah.
Awesome. Which gives us lots of stuff to think about in terms of education as a whole. So this is very interesting. So you guys are primarily about how to engage with culture, and it's with a strong emphasis in the political sphere. But that means that you're in very important conversations a lot with people who have quite a bit of influence and have all sorts of ideas about what's going on at the moment and how we best engage. And I'm imagining you have a pretty good handle on how Christians engage in positive and not so positive ways. So it'd be really interesting to hear from you. What do you see as the biggest needs for Christians engaging in culture right now? Which is a very broad question. So you can talk about content, but you could also talk about the way we go about it as well.
Yeah, that is a really big question. And I think all of those things are important answers. I would say that the most, if you have to pick out a single thing, it's to have a really clear sense of who we are. We're surrounded by voices that want to disciple us, and primarily, I think what we mean by that, and I know that you and others have done a lot of thinking about the kind of cultural liturgies and things like that that the world seeks to influence us with. But primarily, what we mean by that kind of discipleship in the world and also in our Christian communities is to give us a sense of who we are, out of which flows what we do. And I think when we come to the New Testament, we see that's precisely what the Bible is doing as well. It's giving us a sense of who we are. And the logic of Christian ethics is that what you do flows from who you are. That's a very high-level abstract statement, but from it flows a whole bunch of stuff, right? If the primary question for us is to have a strong sense of who we are, then some of the key tasks, I think, are actually forming communities and relationships among Christians that keep teaching us and reminding us of who we are. That's why I think Christian schools have such an important place in our Christian community. Just as an aside, I'm a board member of a CEN school as well, so I'm a big fan. And I think that's what we're increasingly seeing the need for. We need that at all stages of our lives, not just when we're young people and emerging adults. We need it through our churches. We need it as we enter into our workplaces. And I think one of the most important ways that we do that is by forming really thick, relationally rich, theologically deep Christian communities. As I said, the church is at the forefront of that. That's always been God's plan for how his people would be shaped and live in the world. But I think that there are a whole bunch of things that sort of hang off the side of that and go into supporting what the church does. And Christian schooling is part of that. What we do is part of that as well. Yeah.
I think it can get very topical, especially in an election year, around what is, I guess, a key issue or a key thing we need to be thinking about. Without wanting to dive headfirst into some of the spicy topics, I mean, you've got all sorts of complicated stuff going on in Europe, especially with immigration. You've got the classic arguments coming up in America around the key issues around voting. And then you've got an Australian context, which is different, but very influenced by a lot of this stuff. And it can get very confusing to know how to engage well. I think perhaps we've realized that debating on Facebook isn't too effective. And so if we can put some meat on the bones for, you know, developing a strong sense of who we are and what that means. I mean, there are lots of vague concepts we can throw around, like being in Christ. But again, what does that mean in the political space? So have you got any ideas around, you know, how we land this stuff when we are thinking about these really complex ideas?
Yeah, I like you, perhaps, don't mind jumping into the spicy topics. But as I get older, I realize that actually I know less and less about lots of these things, and my answers sound dumb to me and probably even dumber to the people who are listening. And so I've started to reflect a little bit on how do we improve the quality of the conversations as opposed to these are the right kinds of answers. For me, I think I've always found quite helpful the four quadrants. I think it was actually originally five, that were proposed by a guy called Richard Niebuhr back in the day in a book called Christ and Culture, that kind of maps out basically how Christians think about relating to culture. More recently, Tim Keller kind of did a reversioning of that in a book called Center Church. And so he kind of talks about there being the counterculturalists, the people who just want to form a community kind of separated from the world. The transformationists, the people who want to get out there and are convinced that Jesus is the Lord over everything, so want to kind of change every policy. The relevance, the kind of people who actually see that God is working out there in the world and we need to get on board with what he's doing. And the two kingdoms crowd, the people who are trying to think that there's God is ruling over the world, both through everyday life and our workplace and politics, and also through the proclamation of the gospel, and that a good Christian life holds those two things together in some kind of way. What I find really helpful as I think about the kind of spicy issues, which probably become more of a conversation for us when we're in the transformationist camp, right? Like we're trying to think about how does the gospel go out there and change the world, is to realize that I need to have done some work in the other quadrants before I get there. I need actually to have a good Christian community that's showing me what Christian life looks like. But I can't just jump from having a good Christian community straight into transformation. I need to also think about culture and contextualization. What is the mission of God in the world? And so I need to be stretched to remember that God's primary mission and concern in the world is with people, seeing people come to faith in him. So I don't jump straight from Christians are living in a hostile society, my community feels under attack, to the problem of housing affordability or something like that. I go from Christians might be living in a hostile society, we need to develop a good community, and then we need to think about how that community serves God's big picture mission and is going to be a light to the nations, contextually embedded in the society. And actually those two things kind of function as a polarity for us. They're kind of a challenge that we move backwards and forwards. How do I keep making my community strong, but how do I also be outward focused, missionally engaged? And I actually think that's where the two kingdoms kind of stuff comes in a little bit. It's helping us to think through how do our lives express a good order in them between the different kinds of tasks that God has given us. And we need to do a lot of work there, I think. And it's once you've actually thought that out that you then become more effective in the transformationist kind of project. Once you've got a sense of the relationship between the mission of the gospel, the necessity to build a resilient embodied community, the relationship between faith and work, what theologians might even call a kind of hierarchy of authorities in your life, that you become, I think, very effective in cultural transformation. And then you can start to talk about housing affordability or LGBTIQ issues or things like that.
Yeah. Well, what do you think's the danger if we don't do some of that work first? If we sort of jump to a defense or just a proclamation without any of the other stuff, like, you know, what do you see happen if people aren't sort of formed in the right way in that regard?
Yeah, there are two really classic problems. If you're on the more kind of conservative end of the spectrum, and Christians in some ways are perhaps shifting this way because we feel a little bit culturally alienated. And when you do that, you tend to want to kind of hang on to the good things that you've had in the past. And if you feel that way and a bit attacked, what you do is you look at your community or you look at the good things that we had in the past and you try to figure out how to have them again. And so your theory of cultural change is how do we get back what we had? And you know, you can be fairly pragmatic about that. Maybe we just need to be really politically savvy. We need to inflict pain on our opposition, whatever. We don't have to be too ethical about it, maybe even. We just have to achieve this goal, which is to get back what we had, which is a comfortable, rich form of Christian community. And there are many good things about that. I don't want to deny that. If you tend to be on the more progressive end of the spectrum, then your theory of cultural change will be, how do we bring the church more in line with the culture? So we've got to get out there. We've got to see what's going on in the culture around us. We've got to learn from it. And we have to figure out how to change. Our theory of cultural change will be, how do we bring the church more in line with what's going on out there? I think both of those theories have really significant problems. The first one neglects the fact that God is doing new things in the world and that he's called us to be on mission, not just to be comfortable or to reproduce the kind of life that we've had in the past. He might be taking us into all sorts of new places and new seasons. The other end of the spectrum, I think, neglects the reality that we have a mission to change the world, not just to be like the world. And so the further you go down that end of the spectrum, the more that you just become like the world that you're trying to witness to. And so there needs to be a kind of distinctiveness and countercultural witness that we have. That's precisely, it's the tension between those two things that generates really good theological reflection on this. And so unless you've felt both of those tensions, I think you're going to go wrong. You're either going to enter into politics just as a kind of reactionary conservative, everything that you're doing is wrong, we don't like it, it makes us feel bad, or as a kind of very sympathetic, empathetic, kind of progressive, we really want to kind of get on board with the good stuff that you're doing, but really we don't have anything distinctive to say as Christians. We don't want to be in either of those camps, I think.
That's good. For both of us, we'd probably be involved with and be engaged with all sorts of communities. I mean, across, speaking really generally about Australia, what would you see maybe as some of the key temptations, maybe a development of those ideas, but for instance, New Zealand can be overly pragmatic and not want to do the heavy thinking. And if it can get done in a long weekend, then we're all good with that. But what do you see as some of, you know, Australia's temptations when it comes to doing the will and work of God in this particular country, but maybe getting caught up on other things? What ways do we really need to be counterformed in this moment?
Sure, that's a good question. And I don't feel like I have enough of a view from the top of Mount Everest to be able to kind of say something sensible about that. I can kind of tell you the things I observe as I wander to and fro upon the earth. I think it's, you know, in some of the kind of segments of our kind of church community, there is a real pragmatism. And that's actually a part of the church that I really love and am sympathetic to, the kind of entrepreneurial, let's build a thing. We'll ask some questions a little bit later about what's going on here. We're just going to get it done. And you'll find a lot of people like that who are quick to get on board with political lobbying and getting involved in cultural leadership in that way. And that's, like I say, there's something deeply to be loved about that desire just to get a thing done. Of course, it comes with this deep hazard that you can, if you've got a lot of energy and a lot of passion, but you haven't thought deeply about precisely where your convictions are flowing from or going to, you can be recruited to someone else's cause very easily. And I think that happens to Christians all the time in the political sphere, that when we go into parliament and politics, we start playing a game with a bunch of people who are much more savvy about it than most of us are, and who've spent their lives thinking about how to get what they need out of suckers. And Christians often go in there and think they're doing one thing, but they're actually being supporting or being played for a particularly different cause, I think. So you've got to watch out for that. On the other end of the spectrum, there's a really significant proportion or section of Christianity in Australia that has enjoyed being part of the cultural leadership, I guess. I think this is somewhat true in New Zealand. Wherever you've had something like an Anglican church and to a lesser extent the Catholic church, which has had a lot of cultural power, used to having the ear of the cultural elites, we get very used to being told that we have a certain lane that we should stay in. We're the guys who think about morality and how to be nice, and we train the kids on how to live good lives. And that's your lane. You stay in that lane. And if you stay in that lane, you can have all sorts of other really nice things. You can have lots and lots of property, beautiful buildings, tax concessions. You know, we'll roll out the red carpet for you. And it becomes very easy to stay in that lane. And I think there's a lot of Christians who are not feeling that it's the culture is quite as hospitable as it used to be. And they're like, what's going on here? Are we not doing the job that we should go back and do that job even better than we were before? Like, let's tell people how to be nice and live good lives. That's it. I'm not pointing fingers at anyone. I think that's equally problematic. I think what that it tends to do in lots of those churches is create Christians who don't quite know how to live an integrated life. They can have an excellent theology. I'm not just pointing my finger at mainline or liberal churches here. I think lots of our biggest and strongest evangelical churches in Australia are not very good at showing how to integrate our theological convictions with the practical ways that we live in the world, in our workplaces and schools and universities and politics. And a lot of that is because we've gotten used to not doing it. And there's also a lot of cultural pressure to not do it, to kind of live in a sort of schizophrenic way where we know a lot about the Bible, but we live in ways that are practically indistinguishable from the people around us.
So I imagine you've, in your position as CEO, you've been learning a lot about what works, what doesn't, and what really does form people. And I think to turn our attention on the Christian schools and to see that as an amazing opportunity, really, to do something really significant in the lives of thousands of young people across the country. From what you've learned, if you were to somehow end up in some sort of leadership position in a Christian school, and you were then maybe to structure curriculum or the way that the day was constructed, or the year or the term, and or how we meet together, or the kind of things that are covered, or the pedagogy, the method of teaching. This is turning into a very big question. But if you were in some sort of leadership position in a Christian school, what would you see as a real priority straight away and bringing some of those learnings that you've gained now and seeing us sort of be able to form young people and sort of be able to prepare them for the world we have now in effective ways? It's a huge question, but I'm done so well already. I've actually thrown some big ones at you already. So
I'm gonna, like, there's a real possibility here that I end up just looking like a complete fool, because I know that the people who will be listening to this will have thought about it far more deeply than I have, and so please excuse me for pontificating without any expertise. There are a few things that pop into my mind that I've seen as gaps for young Christian emerging leaders that we desperately need to think about how to fill. And these are not necessarily sorted into a very helpful order. The first thing that just popped into my mind actually is that we need to get better and more confident about teaching history. So this is challenging because it's part of a very sore and sensitive spot in our culture. And I don't actually want to be a culture warrior about this. But the reality is that Christians need, Christianity is at its heart a deeply historical faith. Our sacred texts are full of historical narratives that center on the particular historical event of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection. And so we're just committed to knowing about history and thinking about how history works. But one of the things that I think we've become weak on, we've actually become a lot stronger in the last couple of decades on thinking historically about the Bible and doing biblical theology and things like that. Where we're suffering now is that we don't know very much about the history of what happens from Acts chapter 29 through to last year. And what we have there is this great deposit of wisdom and experience of our Christian forebears, thinking through how to live faithful, authentic Christian lives in relation to culture, right through the kind of catastrophic Jewish wars that broke out just after Jesus' death and resurrection, through the fall of the Roman Empire, through this really interesting medieval period where there's a kind of synthesis between Christianity and politics, through a whole bunch of wars and revolutions over the last 500 years. There's a really rich thing for us to learn about there. The problem is that it looks increasingly to our world as though that's a kind of Eurocentric kind of Western civilization program. And to some extent it is. It doesn't have to be exclusively that. And we can do much, much better at thinking about the history of Christianity in other parts of the world and learning about the immensely rich cultural traditions of other parts of the world as well. But particularly for us as Christians, we do have an interest in the way that Christianity built particular cultures around the Mediterranean and in Western Europe, because that's been so formative for us. And I think we have to be willing to teach that and to teach a critical lens on it as well, as we should. But as we do that, to think through how has God been at work and how do we learn how to be faithful disciples in the light of that. Probably the greatest work ever on Christianity and culture, for want of a better term, is St. Augustine's The City of God. And it's striking how much of that book is him narrating the history of Christian people. In fact, he claims to narrate it from the beginning of creation through to his present day. And he thinks that's a really important part of discipleship. So I think that as well. That's a very long answer and one particular thing. I think within our Christian school communities, the other thing that I would love to see us do more of and better is continuing to put in front of each other God's global mission, the way that the gospel is going out around the world. We can feel under attack and threat in our culture at times, but the gospel is unchained and people are coming to faith in incredible numbers all around the world. And we need to keep being presented with the goodness of that happening and the challenge to be a part of it in our generation. And an authentic Christian community is always both attentive to its own internal life and its resilient embodied discipleship program, and attentive to the global scale of the mission that God is calling us to. And I think the danger for us at the moment is to, on the one hand, lose our historical horizon, and on the other hand, to lose our global mission horizon. And I'd love to see us kind of push back on both of those things.
Yeah. That's so interesting. This made me think of another question, which I've been thinking of. You know, I've been in Australia for nearly a year now, and I've been quite surprised at the amount of times I've heard rhetoric around, and this relates to what you're saying about history, around civilizational decline and the way in which we are wanting to address that. Now, that actually sort of really struck me at first, because I was not used to that kind of rhetoric coming from Christians, but it's really strong. So what do you do with that? It's a big question. I'm sure people are looking at certain phenomena and they're painting a picture or building a narrative from that. How seriously should we take that? How much validity does it have? And or how blind are we to bigger forces than we're used to thinking about in that regard? Another spicy one.
Yeah, it is a spicy one. And I spend a lot of time hanging out with people for whom that is their kind of bread and butter, talking like that. And I, you know, I'll potentially get myself into trouble if I disagree too strongly. But I think honestly that is a little bit above our pay grade. I'm struck as a student of history that you can dip into just about any period of history and find people making the argument that we're at a moment of precipitous civilizational decline. So I immediately listen to that language with a little bit of skepticism, because it seems to be a human cognitive bias to kind of think that way. Having said that, we are, I think, almost unquestionably in a period of unprecedented social change. And that's not hard to find empirical data on. Like, for example, when my grandmother was born in 1929, there were 2 billion people, I think, in the world, maybe four, never get the data exactly right. Anyway, it's doubled roughly every generation for the last 100 years. That's just an incredible number of people to add. And then when you think about all sorts of other kinds of transitions, like energy consumption changes and education changes, like there's a lot of evidence to say that we're going through a period where the rates of change are unprecedented in our human history. And that, of course, is going to change, I think, what we mean by things like civilization, the sort of settled cultural norms. Whether you can call that decline or not, I think remains to be seen. There are a lot of good things that I think we are losing, absolutely. And I'm not one to back away from traditional Christian things like the sanctity of life or even things about gender, where I think those are actually really good, not just civilization, but creational realities that God has given us. And for our society to back away from some of those norms is disastrous, I think, unquestionably. But there are also all sorts of other opportunities that come, and there are all sorts of things that I think remain to be determined. The impact of lots of current technology on our social fabric is still being worked out, I think, in really important ways. So we have to be, as Jesus constantly calls us to, we have to be alert and prayerful in this moment, not too quick to react with negativity towards everything, but also not too quick to just be a kind of sunny optimist either. Yeah.
Interesting. Just as I'm listening to you talk, I'm aware that your PhD was on forgiveness, or the ethics of forgiveness. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
In the political space, is that also?
Yeah, I was originally really interested in how it worked out in the political space, but the more time I spent on it, the more that I realized I needed just to do some fundamental work. So it became more and more just about forgiveness per se. Yeah.
Which has been picked up by some cultural commentators like Douglas Murray, saying that we don't really get the necessary social cohesion without something like forgiveness. So it turns out we need something like Christianity to find that cohesion. So did you come across anything like that as you were putting your doctorate together?
Absolutely, actually. I think there's a really interesting, I'm not aware of Douglas Murray stuff. I'll have to go and look it up. But I think there's a really strong historical case to be made there. I can't find any historical evidence, and I really genuinely have spent a bunch of time looking at this, that the concept of forgiveness as we understand it in the West, at least, really existed prior to Jesus, and or outside of cultures that were influenced by Christianity. Now, to kind of make that claim, you have to have a slightly more robust description of forgiveness than just getting over wrongdoing or something like that. Like, you have to mean something a bit specific by that, because there are lots of different ways. Every culture has multiple different ways of dealing with wrongdoing, stretching from punishing to just excusing to just ignoring. And forgiveness is a specific way of dealing with wrongdoing that says that what was done was wrong. It never minimizes the wrongness of the wrong, but at the same time chooses not to treat the offender in the way that would be otherwise authorized because of the way that they did wrong. And I honestly can't find an example of a culture either before Jesus or outside of his influence that has the same kind of concept of forgiveness. And I think, interestingly, it's the Jewish philosopher Hannah Arendt who makes that claim quite powerfully in her book, The Human Condition. She says that Jesus of Nazareth is the discoverer of forgiveness in the realm of human affairs. Yeah, wild, right? And then she goes on as well to kind of talk about forgiveness in relation to politics and says that forgiveness is what gives us the opportunity to not be imprisoned by our past. And so, yes, a society that doesn't want to be trapped in endless cycles of revenge or reciprocal violence needs forgiveness. Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, okay. This is going off a little off script, because that's very interesting. And we've got some big things happening in both our countries at the moment around stuff that's happened in the past and forgiveness and how we address the past well, do what's right, but also not be trapped in it. So one of the big things that our principals are wrestling with is being able to integrate ideas, practices, and language from our Indigenous populations. And there's a lot of hurt there, and there's a lot of wrongdoing that does need to be addressed. A lot of them, though, are worried about syncretism and about doing that in the wrong way. Is there any guidance you can give around how do we actually address that wrongdoing without actually maybe bending to some of the other ideology, which seems to suggest a bit of a binary of good, bad with certain groups? Is there anything you've got around that can be helpful?
Yeah, it's a great question and lots of stuff to think about. There's I think my answer could go in a couple of different directions here, and I'll probably forget some of the things that are probably worth saying. But on the one hand, just think about forgiveness specifically in relation to historic injustice, particularly I think we're thinking about Indigenous dispossession of land and destruction of culture. I think a robust understanding of forgiveness requires a deep appreciation of the wrong that was done. And so, and I'm sometimes a little bit skeptical of those on the more conservative end of the spectrum who actually sometimes want to use the language of forgiveness, but also want to skip very quickly over the acknowledgement of wrongdoing to the, okay, let's move forward kind of moment. And I do not know of a genuine definition of forgiveness that can do that. And it certainly doesn't work that way in individual.
Is that the sort of get over it and get on with it kind of mentality?
Yeah. And particularly it's particularly egregious when it comes with a claim to the party that was wronged that they should forgive. That might be true at an ethical level, like at an objective level, but it's hardly ever a helpful thing to say to someone who's struggling with the effects of wrongdoing in their lives. Again, if you just think about that in an interpersonal situation, like in your family, how effective is it to tell someone that you've wronged that they should be more forgiving to you? Mm. It just doesn't go well, right? So that's one side. I think if we are genuine about forgiveness, we do have to be open to a genuine investigation of the nature and extent of the wrong that was done. We also have to be robust enough to recognize that not every claim that wrong was done is real or authentic. Like it's very easy, and this is the other half of that equation, it's very easy to build an identity on grievance. And that can be intergenerational and actually become more and more extensive over time. And one of the reasons that we need forgiveness is precisely to stop that happening. And it's right to point that out. That's destructive of societies and cultures. So we need both a proper judgment, and this is where the Christian doctrine of judgment is actually really helpful. We need a proper judgment of what was wrong, that then is followed by the ability to build identities not on grievance and the wrongdoing, but on something beyond that. I don't actually think that you can do that very effectively without a much more robust Christian theology, actually, that includes the belief that there is a just God who judges well, and an eschatology that includes the reconciliation of all things. But you can find ways that sort of inch you a little bit closer towards it, and at better times in our culture, we've done that. That's one part of what you're talking about. The other part, I think, was, you'll have to remind me, was just trying to think through how do we teach and talk about this in school? Is that right?
Yeah. Or even how to understand our faith in dialogue with this stuff without
yeah,
fear.
That's right. Yeah.
Doing that's something really un-Christian.
Yeah. I think this is actually right at the core of things for me in terms of thinking about cultural engagement, which is that our biggest assets and our intellectual thought leaders in this space are our missiologists. They're not like turkeys like me who pontificate about politics and culture. They're the people who think about how do we faithfully take the gospel into unreached contexts. And one of the biggest debates in missiology at the moment, particularly in relation to evangelizing people in Muslim countries, is the question of contextualization. How much of the surrounding culture is it right for us to adopt? And how much should Christianity take on the cultural forms and thought forms of the culture that it's going into? And how much has to stay the same and continuous with the gospel once for all entrusted? Christians have been wrestling with that for millennia, right? Like Hudson Taylor famously kind of shocks everyone by adopting Chinese dress and a Chinese queue. But does that in a way that is faithfully proclaiming the gospel. And we that's what a high school teacher is wrestling with at the moment as well, particularly in relation to Indigenous knowledge. It's the question of authentic contextualization. This kind of goes back to what I was saying a while ago about the danger of moving from our counterculturalist camp. And I think if you're a CEN school, you probably hang out in that camp a fair bit, right? Like you kind of have yourself a vision of yourself as a kind of countercultural community. But when you're under threat, you want to switch over to the transformationist kind of camp and get in there and lobby politics and try and make sure that the rules work in your favor. Or become very suspicious and worried about things like Indigenous knowledge and teaching Indigenous history. What we need to do is not just go from counterculturalist to transformation, but go via mission and missiology, and to think through how do we, Christians have always done this ever since Jesus sent us out. We've gone into other cultures and we've worked out what bits of those cultures are honoring to God and don't need to be changed, and what bits have to be challenged by the gospel, and how do we keep the gospel the same? And we have experts who can help us to do this. So I would say to the kind of high school principal, get in touch with the missiologists at some of the Bible colleges that are sending out missionaries around the world and ask them to come and give you some training. In Melbourne, the Church Missionary Society has its training center there, St. Andrew's Hall. I'm dobbing him in. I don't actually know this guy very well at all, but a guy named David Williams is their kind of missiologist in residence. Every time I hear him speak, I think this guy needs to speak everywhere, and give us some theories about how to be culturally intelligent in our own country. What's, just to kind of keep riffing on that, what's surprising us is that we thought this was our culture, and so we understood it, and suddenly the culture changed and it's not ours anymore. So we've got to go back to the beginning and do all the missiological contextualizing work again. That will probably mean that there are aspects of Indigenous knowledge and cultures that we cannot accept as Christians, that are genuinely syncretistic. And anything, I've said this to friends in New Zealand, and I think we struggle with it in Australia. If there are forms of Indigenous practice that are calling on us as Christians to be involved in a kind of religious worship, we can't do it. At that moment, we're Daniel in the lion's den, right? Like, and so there are certain kinds of, I think this is actually harder in New Zealand in some senses, because some of the kind of practices there, I think, do really kind of call on Christians and others to be involved in prayers that are pretty difficult. But there are all sorts of other Indigenous practices and forms of knowledge that are neither here nor there. And Christians are very free to kind of take them up and to celebrate them and accept them. To be really spicy, I would say an acknowledgement of country is perfectly fine. It's just well within the range of like normal kinds of cultural practices that Christians can adopt. A prayer or a ceremony that seeks to ward off ancestral spirits, no, like that's beyond the pale. There you go.
Yeah, nice. Well, thanks for being willing to do that. I mean, I am just throwing things at you. We had a list of questions that I might go there, but it's not on the list, and so I feel very unfair to have done it. well, just to wrap up, you know, LMI is doing stuff all the time. You're wanting to plug into different communities and find people that this program would be good for, and a bunch of other stuff you've got on. So just as we finish, what sort of things is LMI up to at the moment, and how can maybe some of our graduates start thinking about it, or some of our teachers start to plug into other stuff that you're doing as well?
Yeah, great. Thank you for the opportunity. Yeah, I think CEN is a network that that we have a lot in common with, and can offer stuff to each other as well. I think we regularly have teachers come through and do our programs, both our shorter and longer programs, because I would say teachers are at the front line of these questions around cultural engagement. And even though I've said that, like, our program is has an aim towards people going into politics, you know, 80% of what we do is useful and relevant for every kind of Christian cultural leadership. And to be perfectly honest, if you're a teacher and you get to go and work in Parliament House for a week, that's going to be a great experience anyway, and give you a real insight into what that looks like. So it's certainly our 3-month program. As I said, it's residential, which is a hard thing to do. I freely acknowledge that, but you might be at a point in your career where you can actually take some leave to really invest in your professional development. We'd love to hear from you. Come and be a part of one of those programs. We also do run some shorter programs throughout the year. Probably the key one would be a program we call Categoria, which runs in spring and is a four-day weekend where we try to do a bit more of an intensive version of some of the themes that we do in our longer program as well. We've just had that a couple of weeks ago, but if people sign up for our newsletter or check out our website at lmi.org.au, you can find more info about those things.
Great. Well, so good to be able to connect with you and to make people aware of LMI if they haven't already, and just to hear from other organizations in the country that are really doing the same sort of work but in a different sphere and thinking about similar things. So stoked to be able to hear from you and to hear some of the thinking you're doing, and thanks for being able to divulge some of that and talk through some of those important stuff with us. We really think that's so great. So thanks for your time.
Thanks, Sam. It's a real honor to be with you, mate.
Yes, thanks.